If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
As I'm sure you already know, this podcast is produced by the team behind BBC History Magazine, and we're pleased to bring you a very special offer. Subscribe to BBC History Magazine today, and you can choose a book worth up to £30. Choose from either Queens of the Crusades by Alison Weir, The Children of Ashen Elm by Neil Price, Agent Sonia by Ben McIntyre, or The Story of China by Michael Wood. Not only that, you'll also get every issue of BBC History Magazine delivered direct to your door, all from just £22.45. To take advantage of this fantastic offer, visit our official online store at buysubscriptions.com/historybook. This promotion is only available for UK residents and while stocks last. You'll receive your book within 28 days of ordering.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. Last week, the winner of the 2020 Kundal History Prize was announced. The prize, of which we are a media partner, is awarded for the best English language history books. In today's episode, our deputy editor, Matt Elton, caught up with the winner, historian Camilla Townsend, who received the award for her book, Fifth Son, A New History of the Aztecs. Matt asked Camilla about her reaction to the award and the challenges of writing global history for a popular audience.
So I'm here today with Camilla Townsend, who is the winner of the 2020 Kundal History Prize. Camilla, the judges said some really lovely things about your books. They said it was crisp, beautifully written, shows real passion and enormous expertise. How does it feel to have won?
It's rather overwhelming, I have to say. I literally almost couldn't believe it when they first said it. And even now, days later, I'm still having trouble adjusting my mind to it. I think it's really a testament, not so much to me as it is to the sources themselves, these indigenous writers of the 16th century. They did such a good job that it was easy for me to do a good job.
And that's one of the things the judges praised, is your ability to use these sources and kind of research using this language, which isn't broadly known today. Could you talk us through, for people who might not know, what your book's about and which sources you did use in writing it?
Right. The book is about the history of the Aztec people from about 100 years before the Spanish conquest to about 100 years after. So the conquest itself is pivotal, but it's not the beginning of all things or the end of all things. The sources that I used to write it were written in the Nahuatl or Aztec language in the 16th and very early 17th century. What's unique about the project so far, it won't remain unique forever, is that these sources were written entirely off the European radar screen. That is, the Spaniards didn't even know that these histories were being written. What we've had so far, besides the usual histories based on Spanish sources or based on archaeological digs, we've had studies based on sources that were written by indigenous people, but working hand in hand with Spanish friars. So the Spanish friar would say, for example, is it not true that you worship the dastardly God who believed in human sacrifice? And they would say, oh yes, we worshiped the dastardly God who believed in human sacrifice. So then you end up with a history that's really based on responses and categories set up by Europeans. This study is different in that it works with sources written by Aztecs for Aztecs with their own grandchildren in mind. They never expected that we would be reading these histories. I think they'd be glad that we have, actually, because they didn't want to be forgotten. But they were based on an old tradition called the Xupohuali, a way of telling history that they had had for many generations. The only difference was that they used the Roman alphabet that they had learned with the Spanish friars to write these histories down, to transcribe these oral performances. So if you read a lot of them, you can put together quite a bit about their history. And that's what I have tried to do.
Was it difficult getting to grips with this type of source?
Well, yes, I suppose it was a bit difficult. It is always time-consuming to learn another language. And I did begin my study in the 1990s. It was probably only 5 to 10 years ago that I think I really got good enough to get some of the nuances of what they were talking about. But, you know, the bigger issue probably is not so much the language. There are plenty of other people around the world who do study Nahuatl, and there are, in fact, 1.5 million native speakers in Mexico today. The thing is, you can't just read one or two of these histories. You have to read an awful lot of them and recognize the patterns in them. Otherwise, since they weren't written for us, they just seem strange. You just get a sense of other people doing things and understanding history very differently than we do, and you're left rather uncertain what to make of it. But once you read a lot of them, you begin to see what it is that matters to these historians and why they're constructing things the way they are. And then you can put it in terms that modern and Western readers can make something of. So to that extent, it was difficult. Okay.
Do you think that difficulty is one of the reasons why these sources and these stories aren't perhaps as widely known in the West as they otherwise should be?
It absolutely is, because in truth, I would say beginning in the 70s and, well, even a bit earlier, Western scholars and the reading public have been interested in the perspectives of the other, as we sometimes say. So it simply isn't true that it hasn't occurred to anybody to ask what Native Americans thought of this or that situation. But because of the difficulty of accessing these sources in a meaningful way, we've often been left with these other kinds of sources that I described that were written sort of half in Spanish or entirely in Spanish with the guidance of Spaniards. It has been hard for us to read these texts the way they deserve to be read. And I think that is exactly what has kept people away for a while, but not for much longer, I think.
And this is obviously an impossibly broad question, but what different picture emerges of these people when we look at them through their own eyes compared to the sources we're perhaps more used to?
Right. In some ways, of course, we do get the familiar story. That is, the Spaniards didn't lie about the order of events. So when one reads this book, I think a typical reader would find the same history that they expect to find on one level. You know, the Europeans arrive, the battles happen, the Europeans win. But it does enrich the picture, I think, to get the behind the scenes, the perspective of those who didn't win those battles and therefore didn't get to write the histories. For example, there's an old story that has been much repeated that the Aztecs were waiting for the return of their god, Quetzalcoatl. And these Aztec histories make very clear that that's simply not the case. There was no such prophecy, and they did not think Cortes was a god. So you can only maintain that belief if you continue to read sources written by Spaniards or influenced by Spaniards in the later part of the century. When you read their histories, that just disappears. And in fact, you end up seeing some rather savvy generals and political leaders who were trying to figure out why the Europeans had this technological edge and trying to figure out what they were going to do about it, far from worshipping at, you know, at the altar of these new gods.
Something else the judges said was that your book reminds us of the need to look harder at Indigenous people's stories and also about the way in which history gets written as a whole. Do you think that's right? And do you think that your book says something about the way that we should consider these sorts of histories more generally?
Yes, that's a very interesting point. I think what happens when we don't really understand the other people in the story is that we allow ourselves, that are the cultural heirs of the winners, we allow ourselves to paint rather flattering portraits of ourselves or our sort of figurative ancestors in what happened. I guess what we just touched on is a great example. The lasting nature, the longevity of this story about Hernando Cortes being perceived as a white god, it's kind of surprising when you think about it that that would last right through the multicultural era, right into the politically correct early 2000s. But on some primal level, it's so flattering to think that they thought my forebears were gods. I mean, so we are not only going to tell a more, sort of offer a more accurate rendition, but I think stop ourselves from just feeding our own vanities, creating narratives that feed our own vanities, which ultimately weakens us and makes us less wise. And we can do this better if we really hear what the other people have to say about what was going on.
When you're writing a book like this, do you have in your mind what might happen to it after it's published, or can you only really think about it up until it's finished on the page?
Mostly, I think I can only think about it as I'm writing on the page. The one exception is that one does have to imagine a bit of an audience. Otherwise, you change voice. When I was a younger writer, I think on some unconscious level, I sometimes imagined different people. Sometimes it was my grandmother. Sometimes it was a student. Sometimes it was some educated reader of the New York Times or the London Times. And so I would change my voice and change my perspective, and editors would have to slap my hand, figuratively speaking. I think I was imagining an audience, but that audience was sort of an advanced undergraduate audience. I was talking to my students. I was talking to educated lay people, in other words. Of course, I did have things to say that my fellow scholars needed to hear, but I wasn't writing the book for them, per se, on any kind of unconscious level. So I was far, far from imagining that it would ever win any prizes. It wasn't the point. The point was to tell the history as the Aztecs would have wanted it to be told, according to my understanding of what they wanted, because there's so much silliness out there, so many silly things still written about the Aztecs. And when I'm designing courses and assigning things to students or just recommending things to colleagues, I used to have a bit of trouble because there is so much out there that, although readable, is just deeply wrong. And I now know how wrong it is now that I know their sources. So yes, I imagined it a bit beyond the writing of the page, but I wasn't thinking about prizes, just communicating with these people that I'm used to communicating with, students and colleagues. It has been a great joy for me that it has won. And I think that is because it does matter to me very, very much that these Indigenous sources be known. So often we hear, oh, you know, only the winners get to tell the story, so there's really nothing much we can do. And of course, that's not the case in this case. There are lots and lots of sources written in Indigenous languages. So I hope that this helps shine a light on that fact.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
The world is ready now to hear the perspectives of others from their own angle of vision and even in their own words. We've long been willing to give lip service to the idea that all people mattered. I'd say that started big time in the 1970s, although, as I said, even earlier in some ways. But this is different. We seem now to be willing to really hear in some depth the perspective of other people.
We don't always realise just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does, or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger, talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
eBay Motors is here for the ride. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only, exclusions apply.
Is it a challenge sort of taking that responsibility of telling these people's stories and translating it to a popular audience?
It's very much of a challenge. It's interesting that you're aware of that. I think few people are. Rather, it seems easy somehow to write a book that is readable rather than one that's written in erudite prose with lots and lots of subordinate clauses, right? But in truth, I have found that writing a really readable book, but that nevertheless accurately represents profoundly different cultures, or that raises very difficult issues, I have found that to be a very difficult to do in straightforward language. And indeed, early readers of early drafts said that I wasn't succeeding very well. So, for instance, I might refer to a particular person, let's say Chimalpahin. To me, he's a familiar guy, but my readers of these early drafts would say, I'm sure you told us who he is, but I don't remember. This is, you know, it's not like you're referring to Winston Churchill or Franklin Delano Roosevelt. We don't remember. So I had to figure out how to remind everybody in a quick sentence who this guy was, but without going back to retread the same ground. I think I got better at it over time as I worked on these drafts. And that's where, great publishers come in handy. It was Oxford's University Press that helped me through that process.
And how long does that process take of writing this book? When did you first start this research up until the time in which it was published?
Well, if you ask about the research, then in effect, we're going back to the 1990s when I first started studying the Nahuatl language and began to realize the richness of the sources that exist in that language. I suppose one could also say it began about 10 years ago when I got very serious about studying the annals, the Shupo Huali, the year counts, the histories that they wrote. I had won a Guggenheim Award specifically to study those annals, and it was in that year that I began to realize not only do I need to write a book about these sources, you know, for other scholars, the history of these sources, I need to tell the history that's in these sources for everybody. So I guess you could say something less than 10 years ago I got serious about it, and then it was a process of about 4 years to actually write the book. It takes a long time, in other words. Yeah, it's a short book, but there's a lot of time in there.
And what's interesting is that at the moment, there seems to be renewed or perhaps even new interest in telling the stories of groups outside the West or groups whose voices haven't been told, such as this. Do you think this reflects a wider sort of cultural shift? I know you said this has been in the works for many years. Do you think, though, that there's a wider shift towards this kind of history?
I absolutely do. I think it's notable that all three of the top finalists in the Kundal process were books about the non-West, in effect, about colonialism's effects, in one case in India, in one case in the Caribbean, and in one case in Mexico. I actually asked the jury afterwards, was it the case that they ended up looking for such books, since all three were? And they said, no, these rose naturally to the top, and that they too were surprised at how many books in the pool were in fact about what we shorthandedly call non-Western themes. It does seem to me that the work of the last decade or so is really coming to fruition now, and undoubtedly will continue, that, as you say, the world is ready now to hear the perspectives of others from their own angle of vision, and even in their own words. We've long been willing to give lip service to the idea that all people mattered. I'd say that started big time in the 1970s, although, as I said, even earlier in some ways. But this is different. We seem now to be willing to really hear in some depth the perspective of other people. And I think that's wonderful and opens up new horizons to your generation and the next generation. I really do. Okay.
Are there things that you think global popular history still needs to do better?
Well, I suppose, here I am a bit of a homer for my own team, but I do suppose that more people should study other languages. English really is the lingua franca. I mean, just think of the ease with which we can have this conversation, and around the world too. As you know, if someone from Kazakhstan meets with someone from Sweden, they tend to speak in English. And indeed, because of Britain's former power, many of the colonial sources are actually written in English too. I believe Vincent Brown's work was based largely on English sources, for instance. So we can do a lot. We can do a lot with English, and then add in Spanish and French even more. But I do hope that there are more and more scholars, young scholars, who are willing to put in the time and energy that it takes to study other languages, indigenous languages, languages that represent the other on a more profound level, because it will make a big difference. I think this is a case in point.
Are there recent history books that you particularly enjoyed?
You know, I really think that what I want to say, because it's what I really mean, everybody should read the other two finalists, The Anarchy and Taki's Revolt. I have asked for copies for Christmas myself, talking with the authors and about the books, listening to the tapes about them, have demonstrated to me how rich these studies are. And I'm very happy to sort of take the word of the Kundal Committee. So I think that they would be where I would start.
What was really nice for me getting to talk to the people involved in this prize was it got me to read books that I may not necessarily have come across otherwise. Do you think that's one of the values of this kind of award?
I absolutely do. I have been struck throughout the process of how much work the prize organization, the Kundal organization, and then later the jury did in that regard. They begin with a long list, then it moves to a short list, then the top three, and then finally the winner. And at each stage, they are in effect advertising in meaningful and intellectual terms the work that is going on in the field of history around the world. And I can't think of a better way to do that, really. They too commented, one of the judges commented on how rich the world of historical writing is right now. And as you say, most of us wouldn't find out about these books that are far from our own fields or far from our own areas of interest without such competition. So I think it is a terrific job that they're doing in that regard.
And what's next for you, and I suppose the book?
Well, I think perhaps what's next for the book is that it shall appear in Spanish in Mexico quite soon. That was actually going to happen anyway, but now it will happen faster and with more interest. And I think that that's good. Many Mexicans have written about the Aztecs also, and many of them will undoubtedly soon surpass this book because some of them also know these sources. This perhaps might inspire more of them to write other synthetic works that bring more attention to the marvelous heritage that they have there. So I suppose that's what will happen next in that regard. As for me, I'm actually working now on a quite a different project about the Lenape or Delaware people who lived in the New York City area. Some of their stories were written down before the language disappeared. It isn't entirely gone yet, but it largely is. And I'm working with a Delaware co-author on that study. So hopefully we'll have more to say about the ancient peoples in the New York City area sometime soon.
Okay. I mean, how do you decide what project to choose next?
You know, I rarely have made a conscious choice. The projects come to me in some sense. I started to study Nahuatl because I was writing a sort of biography about Doña Marina, the woman who translated Fernando Cortés, and I thought, I should learn this woman's language, even though she didn't write in it. I should just have exposed myself. And it was in doing that that I discovered the sources, and in discovering the sources, I wrote a book about the sources, and then I realized I should write the book that's in the sources. And the Lenape project came to me as well. Somebody brought the idea to me that we here at Rutgers Public University ought to know more about the people whom we have displaced. So over and over again, I find it's rather serendipitous. The gods bring the studies to me, in effect. I wish I could say I had a concerted plan, but I can't.
Thank you so much for your time, because I know you're super busy at the moment, so I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you. It's been a great pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much.
That was Camilla Townsend. Fifth Son, A New History of the Aztecs, is out now, published by Oxford University Press. You can also hear an in-depth interview with Camilla, along with those of fellow finalists William Dalrymple and Victor Brown, in our back catalogue at historyextra.com/podcasts. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt and Jack Bateman. Join us tomorrow when Chris Harding will be giving a lecture on the history of Japan.